From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made back in November, when more than 75% of Rochester voters approved a referendum to create a police accountability board. The PAB is tasked with investigating complaints of misconduct made against Rochester police officers and with reviewing Rochester Police Department patterns, practices, policies, and procedures. After a call for applications, City Council approved the 9-member board in January. Members include healthcare professionals, spiritual leaders, and community service providers. In May, a state Supreme Court judge stripped the board of its disciplinary powers, essentially. City Council appealed that ruling this month, and right now, the issue is still being litigated. The board isn't meeting in person due to the pandemic, but its members are conducting independent research. This amid conversations about police-community relations and defunding the police. And when you think about the calls for reform across the country, think about what Governor Andrew Cuomo said. Think about what other governors or other activists in other places have said. They want maybe prosecutors from outside the county where allegations happen, or they want a board that's independent that could review it. And Rochesterians could be forgiven if you think, well, didn't we already have that? Didn't we do that in November? Isn't that what the PAB is supposed to be? The answer is yes, but there are still questions about what it can and cannot do. So this hour we sit down with some members of the PAB, talk about their roles, their work, how they see that, and perhaps their perspective as these discussions about police reform swirl all around the country. I'd like to welcome our guests now. The chair of the PAB is Shawnee Wilson, an activist, physician assistant who specializes in internal medicine, one of the really thoughtful voices we've had on this program. And Shawnee, it's great to have you back. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Great to be here. Thanks, Evan.
Also with us is Dr. Celia McIntosh, vice chair of the PAB and a nurse practitioner. Dr. McIntosh, welcome to the program.
All right, thank you.
And Rabbi Dror Settle is with us, who's a member of the Police Accountability Board and rabbi at Temple Emmanuel. Rabbi, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Shawnee Wilson, as the chair of the PAB, I will start with you, and I must say, you know, in so many places after the killing of George Floyd, there were calls for a wide range of reforms. Those calls continue now. Obviously, this is an ongoing discussion of reform. But one of the common threads was this idea that, well, at the very least, there should be independent bodies that can investigate. And I think a lot of people in our community thought we had already did that, or we voted for that, or we already have that. I think that there are questions about disciplinary power. But, you know, as you see those calls around the country, do you understand maybe the confusion that people have when they go, wait, don't we have that here? Isn't that what the PAB is, right?
Yeah, so I certainly do understand. And I think, you know, as things certainly changed as soon as we started meeting from day one, there was an injunction placed on what we can and cannot do with the Police Accountability Board. And so, you know, I know that, you know, we are still working through that litigation right now, so there's not much I can comment on, but there has been that's where I think the confusion came in. So we are not allowed right now to have disciplinary oversight. And so that is what we're working through right now. So, but that's, I think, where that confusion started.
Can I ask you, Shawnee, do you think voters back last year who voted overwhelmingly in the mid-70s for this PAB, mm-hmm. I mean, it was not close, do you think voters voted intending to create a board that does have disciplinary power?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, I do. Yeah, I think that was the will of the people. You know, this memory takes me back of last year when I was talking to people about the Police Accountability Board and running around in some of the high rise buildings where a lot of people, black and brown people, live, talking about the need for independent disciplinary oversight. And everybody that I spoke with completely agreed and shared their own stories of police misconduct or had their own concerns about how police actually deal with the public here in Rochester. So, yes, I do.
Okay, and the reason I ask that is not to sort of try to load up this debate about what happens next with this court case or what a judge might say,
yep.
But
mm-hmm.
just to understand what voters were pretty clearly trying to create in November. Now, that doesn't mean that a judge is wrong or I'm weighing in on that, but I do think it's valuable as we look at the conversation about reform across the country to talk about what we currently have here, what voters intended to have, and what the current state of the PAB is, because right now the PAB is not what voters thought they were getting, and it may not be. It depends on where it goes in court. So without saying too much about the court case, Shani, do we have an expectation of the timeline then for that?
So I know that the timeline is probably looking like fall, where there's going to be some more things happening within the court system, as far as I know.
Okay. So then I'll start with you, Shani. I'll ask all three of our guests from the Police Accountability Board this next question then. If the scenario doesn't change, in other words, if you don't end up with disciplinary power on the Police Accountability Board, does that invalidate the mission? I mean, is that the most important part of the work? Do you see it as a kind of a what's the point situation, given what people thought they were voting for? Or do you see it differently, Shani?
Oh, gosh, no. I mean, so listen, I mean, even if there is no disciplinary oversight, there is still the four P's that you were, talking about accessing, patterns, practices, policies, procedures when related to the Rochester Police Department. There are still things that can be done. Like, for instance, we would love to see more disciplinary training or training around institutional racism and bias within policing. I have questions about, how much of that, how much training they're actually getting, and is it actually really comprehensive and thorough? Is it a part of the cadet training? Is it a part of, how many hours of training do they need to have? So there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of questions that we can ask, and there's a lot of policies and procedures that we can strongly encourage be done, or changes that can be made within the system. Definitely.
Dr. McIntosh, how do you see it?
Exactly. I mean, so definitely we will continue to work on these policies. We will continue to hoping to do some education ourselves to learn more about what policing, overall is. And then definitely to try to, if we end up not having this disciplinary power, to be able to make some recommendations. But I wanted to kind of go back to one of your questions.
Sure.
That you had proposed to Chair Wilson,
mm-hmm.
when we talked about, you said the proposed PAB, when we talked about what were they getting, so the initial five essential pillars that were proposed mm-hmm. were an independent agency of city government separate from RPD, the power to independently investigate complaints of police misconduct, subpoena power to compel the production of evidence and witnesses, disciplinary power, and the power to review and evaluate RPD policies, patterns, practices and procedures to recommend systemic change and to prevent misconduct from happening in the first place. So I definitely see that even the work that we're doing, the community is really wanting that systemic transformation within these systems, and we will be still working towards that goal.
Okay. Rabbi Settle, how do you see it?
So if you look at the legislation, there are, except for administrative duties, 14 areas in which we have responsibility, and only two of those are impacted by the court decision. So there's a question right now about investigation and also about working on the matrix, the extent to which the police need to cooperate with us on that. But that leaves 12 other large areas of responsibility that are completely unaffected. And my concern is that the way But that court decision was discussed publicly, particularly in the media, made it sound like it had shut down the PAB. And I really want to get out the message that the opposite is true, that we have a huge amount of work that we can still do, and that, we are going ahead with all of that.
I think that's perfectly valid, and maybe my own voice is even part of that. I do think it is important to stress the disciplinary aspect, just because, when you look at Congress, for example, should Congress investigate itself? When, should police investigate themselves? I think any organization probably needs some outside oversight if there are allegations. Otherwise, it's hard to gain public trust. And if that doesn't happen here, there will probably be issues with trust going forward. But I want to say, Rabbi, I certainly take the point,
yeah.
And I don't mean to invalidate the other branches of the work.
No, but I also want to say, too, that, yes, the outside oversight, obviously, as a religious leader, I know that we have not done, ministers, priests, rabbis, whatever, have not done the best job of regulating our own behavior, shall we say. So I agree with that. But I also think in a democracy that what's different about police or the army is that they are armed forces, and that the need for civilian oversight in those situations is even more important. And that while the mayor's oversight of the police chief allows some civilian oversight, I think that the community itself really wants a more sort of democratic process and say in how that happens. And obviously issues of the use of arms is really at the forefront for a lot of people, and or the use of force in this discussion.
Let me also bring in Ida Perez, who's with us now, a member of the Police Accountability Board and chair of the Scranton Bleak Street Block Club and director of Ibero Early Childhood Services. Ida, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Well, we were talking about the role of the PAB in this community. Ida, how comfortable are you that the public now is getting a better understanding of what you and your fellow board members are tasked with doing, and how much confusion do you think there is in the public about it?
Well, I think there's still a little confusion just based on everything that's happened up to this point. I think that for me in particular, it's very important for me to let my community know that we're there, that we're listening. Obviously, we're waiting for certain processes to be in place so that we can do the work that we were asked to do, right? But I think there's still some confusion as to what exactly are we doing, what can we do, what can we not do. And so helping people understand that and the process that we need to go through until we get to that point is important for me.
Yeah, fair enough. And before we talk more about what the board has been doing, especially most recently and say in recent weeks or during the pandemic, or maybe what the most pressing priorities are for the board, I want to ask a question about white police officers and where we are in this country in terms of understanding why white police officers are out of step with the general white population. That's not a subjective statement. That is based on research, and I'll read the research now. Pew Research surveyed police officers. Here is what white police officers say when asked whether the United States has made the changes that have been needed to give black people equal rights with whites. Has the U.S. made those changes that are necessary? 92% of white police officers say yes, this country has done enough for racial equality. 57% of white people in general in this country say yes. It is a 35-point difference. So that's not a subjective statement when I say white police officers are out of step. They just are. A much, much larger number of white police officers think, I mean, there are very few white police officers by numbers who think that we need to do more to achieve racial equality in this country. Most think we've done enough. Shawnee Wilson, what do those numbers say to you, and how serious an issue is that to you?
Well, I would say that the numbers say to me that there obviously is a disconnect between, I would say that there's a disconnect, and it's glaringly apparent that, you know, the system works, the perception of how the system works is definitely skewed. Right. I think that, you know, systems are put in place to benefit some and then not benefit others. And I think that is historically true for this country, historically true for policing. You know, there is the fact that it's 92%. It does not surprise me. I think that, you know, when it comes to the system of policing, I think that, you know, when you talk to the officers on the street, you know, looking like, you know, taking like a larger view, you know, a lot of officers would say, well, you know, their perception is that they're doing the best that they can, and that they believe that, you know, within the realm of policing, that they're doing the best that can be done, or they're doing what they need to do. So, but unfortunately, a lot of the times we know that research, and we know from the national news that really looks like, you know, over policing and a lot of times harassment of people in black and brown people. And so that does not surprise me at all.
And just to follow up with you, Shawnee, before I talk to your colleagues, is this an issue, if it's a problem, if the 92 versus 57% thing is a problem, is this an issue of recruitment, of who sort of gets sorted into these jobs?
That's a great question. So I believe, and I know that we talked about this at the community meeting that happened a couple weeks ago. And honestly, I say yes and no. I think that's a pretty big question. I would say my first answer is no, because I believe that the system is what needs to change. And I don't think if you bring Black people or brown people into the system, they will acclimate to the system and function according to how the system functions, right? And there's a lot of reasons for that. It's about, you know, it's about belonging. It's about, you know, feeling part of a team. But it's also about, you know, just like in the military, it's like, if I can't trust you to have my back in a certain situation, you know, and I'm getting shot at, you know, I just want to make sure that I'm safe if we're in a volatile situation and, you know, I need somebody to have my back. Mm-hmm. And if I don't know if you have my back within a situation where, you know, I'm being accused of harassment or over-policing of a Black and brown person, a person that looks like the potential recruit, the people that you're trying to recruit, then that becomes very dicey. And it really becomes a matter of survival rather than it becomes a matter of sticking up for, or, you know, finding that, like, a lot of people are, you know, a lot of Black and brown people are also part of that problem in certain situations, right? We saw in George Floyd's case where, you know, they had, there were people of color standing by while this, you know, this man died. And so I believe that that's a problem with the system and how systems work. We don't allow people to have, we don't give people the room to actually, you know, function well because they're so worried about keeping themselves safe and having to rely on other people.
I'll ask Dr. McIntosh to weigh in as well. And given the fact that Chairperson Wilson brought up the idea, you know, of officers of color as well, let me read the full Pew research on this question. Then again, the question is, has the United States made the changes necessary to give Black people equal rights with white people? Has this country done enough on racial equality? 92% of white police officers say yes, the country's done enough. 57% of the general white public says yes, the country has done enough. 43% say no. And when it comes to Black police officers, 29% of Black police officers say yes, the country has done enough. 12% of the general Black population says yes, the country has done enough. So, I mean, there's a disparity among police officers across racial backgrounds with the general populations, but it is a huge difference with white officers and the white general population. Dr. McIntosh, how serious an issue do you see that?
I mean, I definitely see that it is a big issue. And then, you know, having that mindset or that, there's a lot of factors that go into that. You know, what were the ages of these officers that they screen? What are their environment? You know, like, where do they live? You know, because, like I said, or I would be also interested in understanding, like, okay, so tell me some of those specific things that, you know, you feel like the country has shaped or is different. This is, you have to understand that this mindset of the 92% white officers, it plays into everything. It, you know, is this a general bias? Is this something that they know for fact? Is this something that this mindset just being passed down from generation to generation, where they haven't really looked into the research and it's just kind of like, well, you know, just kind of hearsay? So I think there needs to be a lot more going into that. But I think there is a imbalance, as you can see, and it plays into the work that they do, into the communities that they serve. And overall, it's just, yes, it's a big problem.
Rabbi Settle, how do you see it?
So I'm thinking about this, I look at the work of two scholars. One is Alex B. Cal, who sort of says that we can look at practices, policies, and procedures till the cows come home, but unless we look at the patterns, i.e. the culture of policing, we're not going to solve this problem. And for me, part of the root of it is I look at here at the work of Daniel Goleman, who wrote about emotional intelligence, but also I'm a big believer in restorative practices. And here he talks about how basically segregation of any type, whether it's economic, racial, gender, whatever, produces a sense of otherness between groups. And that as long as there isn't the building of relationship and deep connections between people, they won't see other people as being like themselves. And I see that in what I read. I've been reading since getting on the PAB, not just materials about policing, but by police. And I see that sort of distance in their attitudes. So I guess sort of coming from my background, and maybe I'm overly optimistic, but I think some kind of program that works on building relationships is at the heart of how we can change that.
Okay. And Ida Perez, what do you think?
Well, you know, I agree with all of my board members. I think it is a cultural and a system problem that we have. It doesn't surprise me at all. I think that if you were to ask that, and it's not necessarily police officers, but just the community at large, you'll probably get the same response, you know, from most white people. They don't see the issue at all. But I think, again, it's part of the system, and it's part of the culture. I think that even, you know, good officers that whether they're black or white, once they go into that system, there may be some expectations from them that, you know, changes the way that they behave with the community. So, or you know, just see what they're doing is okay, right? So I think it's all of those things combined.
Well, and so let's just now talk a little bit about how you know, are going to do the work that you do, especially in this climate here. I don't know, and I'll ask Chair Shawnee Wilson of the Police Accountability Board, if you can or want to talk about some of the most pressing kinds of parts of public discourse regarding police reform. For example, defunding police or even abolishing police. I don't know if that's in the scope of the PAB. Does the PAB take positions on those things?
So, no, collectively, we cannot take a position right now. So I have my own thoughts. I mean, you call it defunding, reframing, reimagining. You know, we already know that there needs to be, you know, here's what I'll say. I think that, you know, I think that we rely on police to do everything. And instead of allocating dollars towards, and I think we all can agree on that. You know, I think that, you know, we rely on police to do a lot of things. And, you know, a lot of times they're the domestic violence service provider. They're the social worker. They're the counselor. They're, you know, they're trying to do 7 or 8 different roles that really they should be doing 1 or 2 roles. And I think that there should be, you know, a allocation of time, money, and effort going towards, you know, beefing up those things in the community that actually will help the police not feel so overwhelmed with the job that they have. I do believe that.
And
that's just me speaking for
myself.
Yeah,
I know you're speaking for yourself in this case and not the rest of the board. And I take the point that the Police Accountability Board can't necessarily weigh in on those ideas specifically. Individually, Shawnee, do you see it being a worthwhile goal to create a society in which there are no uniformed police officers?
Oh, I haven't even gotten there yet. I think that there's, you know, I think right now in the city of Rochester, you know, there are a lot of issues with, you know, poverty, violence. You know, do I think that, you know, like uniformed police officers, no, I don't think so. The thing that I would like to see first happen is that we start to have, you know, actual actual movements towards getting people in our communities that need help, actually getting them definable help, like people with opioid addiction, mm-hmm. people with, you know, that need care management, which is the majority of my patients as a physician assistant, right? That, you know, they need doctor's appointments. They need rides to doctor's appointments. So, you know, I wonder, you know, when we talk about, you know, anger, violence, and poverty and policing, all of that goes, it's all a big, you know, ball. It's a big mess. And those are kind of the things, like a big ball of yarn. We have to start at one piece to actually sort all of this out. So, no, there's definitely not an easy answer to any of that.
Listeners, you're hearing the chair of the Police Accountability Board, Shawnee Wilson, along with the vice chair, Dr. Celia McIntosh, and members of the board, Ida Perez and Rabbi Dror Settle. And after our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about the work that they are doing right now. Yes, I am among many journalists in town have been following closely the court case and what a judge has said. And in May, State Supreme Court Justice John Ark ruled that the disciplinary power granted to the PAB by city law was in direct conflict with state public employee law and the mayor's authority to engage in collective bargaining with the Rochester Police Union. So for now, there is no disciplinary power that the board has. But as the members of the board have been telling us, that does not mean they don't have significant and even vital work in this community. So let's take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back And we will talk to them about where that work goes next and what they're working on now with the Police Accountability Board here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're joined by Amy Bach, a Rochesterian who is the CEO of Measures for Justice, and she is the author of the book Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court. She'll be leading an event with the National Women's Hall of Fame aimed at helping us understand the impact of a justice system, or, as some might view it, an injustice system. We'll talk about what reform might look like next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, the chair of the Police Accountability Board, Shawnee Wilson. Why don't you start the second half hour by telling our listeners more about the work that the board is doing right now when it comes to whether you're analyzing the current state of police-community relations, research, reforms, et cetera. What's the top priority for the board right now?
So the top priority for us right now is finding an executive director to help us with this work. And so that is the majority of our time. And we are also starting to discuss our own educational curriculum as a board, making sure that, you know, we have a thorough knowledge of policing, thorough knowledge of how, you know, example being like how does discipline work right now? How is the Center for Dispute Settlement? How are they doing their job? You know, what are some vital community resources that we need to be made aware of? You know, when it comes to actually like the anatomy of policing, how do we break that down to make sure that we can't tackle everything, but what are the most important things that we need to know in order to go forward with the jobs that we have right now?
When it comes to finding an executive director, tell me about that search and ultimately, you know, if there's an ideal sort of a candidate or who you're looking for.
So that's a good question. Our applications are closed. They closed a couple weeks ago. So we have a healthy amount of applicants, to be sure. And we are looking for somebody with a criminal justice background. Preferably, but not preferably, we open it up to make sure that even people with, you know, an associate's degree or a doctorate degree can be considered for the position as long as they have, you know, the requirements that we're looking for. So we wanted somebody that was able to live in the city of Rochester within a year of the position. We were looking for somebody who has a thorough knowledge of what's going on locally. Possibly criminal justice background, at least a couple of years of work, either in social work, either in like higher education, or and they had to have some at least like higher level experience, like able to have oversight over a lot of people.
And Shawnee, an email from a listener named Alex who says, "Hold on one second here. This is not from Alex."
Okay.
Different listener, name withheld, retired police officer. Why not a retired police officer on the board? That would help the board with questions about discipline and other issues that they are currently studying on.
Well, we do not, you know, when the legislation went forward for the Police Accountability Board Alliance, they did not feel that, you know, they needed a retired police officer on the actual board itself, and they actually put that within the legislation that was passed by the voters. So I would say that, you know, to the listener, that we do have people that are retired or that people that will be helping us, and I would look to actually help with that type of that type of information, like those that are going to be helping with their educational curriculum, like RIT, the criminal justice program. We have those in the community that have a thorough knowledge of policing that will actually be able to assist us in that work. And that is where I feel like they'll be functional. As far as how the legislation works, that was something that, you know, the PABA thought was necessary. And I agree with their decision. And also that the city of Rochester voted on overwhelmingly. So, you know, long story short, city of Rochester would have rather not had anybody on the board itself that actually was a former law enforcement officer or any law enforcement background.
Beyond finding an executive director in the makeup of the board, Dr. McIntosh, can you tell me a little bit about how you see the next priorities for the board and the kind of work that you'd like to see accomplished?
The next priority would be really, like I said, educating ourselves, you know, to learn more about things. And then really, you know, kind of developing relationships with the community in terms of going forward, really being able to at some point look at the different patterns and practices and policies and procedures of the RPD to really start trying to understand, you know, just a broad range of the law itself and, you know, just the policies and where we can make those recommendations systemic change. Because I know we keep talking about the George Floyd case, but I want to people to really understand that this is not just in 2020 that people really started wanting accountability or transparency in community systems and police systems. You know, according to the 75% of people that wanted, you know, voted the PAB in, it was based on because of the city of Rochester failing to hold police officers accountable for misconduct and brutality. And between 2001 to 2016, citizens in Rochester filed over 923 allegations of excessive force against the RPD, and only 16 of those allegations were sustained. So, like I said, I just really want the community to understand that this is not a new problem. It's been going on for quite some time. And, you know, like I said, really trying to get that accountability and transparency. And like I said, for us really being educated to be able to move forward to the next step so that we're also doing our best for the community.
Yeah, Dr. McIntosh, I certainly take the point. I mean, I think there is more general American engagement with the idea of police reform since the killing of George Floyd. Some of the polling just among white Americans is pretty remarkable when it comes to public disposition about whether there is unequal treatment of Americans by police. Those numbers have shifted rather dramatically in just 2 months since the killing of George Floyd. But, you know, it's you can't always predict which events will galvanize the public. I kind of thought the killing of Walter Scott would have been that, you know, an event in which a man is simply just who's clearly not a danger to police, just running away from police, shot in the back by police. I guess you can't always predict which events will galvanize. I certainly understand why George Floyd's killing has galvanized the public, but I take the point, Dr. McIntosh, that, you know, this the work of the PAB has not been sparked in the last 2 months, that there are decades of questions behind this. And do you find yourself now, Dr. McIntosh, at least feeling that given the focus the American public has put on this issue, that this is a moment to achieve more reforms? Do you feel like it is a short window, or do you think that this has opened a longer avenue to actually get things done?
I definitely think it's opened up a window to get this work done overall. I think this is the time for, to continue the momentum of the movement, to really continue the work that has started because of this. When we talk about, like I said, when you mentioned George Floyd, you know, I think with everything, it was just kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back, and people are, in communities, are just tired of the same old same and want change and want accountability and want answers so we can move forward. And so I do definitely think that the time is now, but we can't also, you know, we can't put a Band-Aid over the situation and just make a few little changes. It really has to be just more than this, you know, isolated reform. It needs to be really systemic. We really need to look at all the systems and get on one accord with everything so there's real change.
Rabbi Settle, you talked about some of that work earlier this hour, and I am curious to know if you see, sort of a similar question for you. When we look at when major reforms happen, sometimes there is a tragic incident that galvanizes public opinion, and that window seems to be brief. Unfortunately, this country focuses on events and moves to the next one quickly. Sometimes a natural disaster will happen, and there will be relief efforts that are really, really heated very quickly, and then the public seems to forget. And I'm curious to know if you think that, as George Floyd's brother said, he said, "My brother will change the world." And, you know, you certainly understand why George Floyd's family feels that way, that they've lost him, but they feel like, you know, his memory is going to create real change. Is this a short opportunity, or do you think that this opens up something more lasting, Rabbi?
So I have two perspectives on that. One is as a person of the 60s, I guess, and always being an optimist about changing the world, I feel very proud to have been part of raising a generation of young people who are not only taking that seriously, but I think doing it in new ways and sustained ways that are going to make some profound changes possible. So I think we are at a moment, but it's also the culmination of many moments that have led to a time when people, and particularly led by young people and people of color, are changing the conversation in our country. So I'm always an optimist, but I think it is a significant moment. On a more practical level, we also have a state where our governor has mandated in 9 months from now, all the police forces, if they want future state funding, are going to have to certify that they've engaged in a rethink about policing. When the governor announced this mandate, he said, "I want you to start with a blank piece of paper." So I think this is also an extraordinary moment and one which has an immediate timeline, but long-lasting repercussions.
Yeah, that's an important point. Before I get Ida's take on this, let me just ask the chair of the PAB, Shawnee Wilson, about that. You know, Shawnee, when the governor made that announcement, I was kind of just taking stock of the wide range of reactions. There was some view among some who've called for reform that this was an indication of seriousness, of really putting the heat on departments to create a real path to change and to be open to the need for change. Others viewed it as sort of more of an empty gesture or doubted that it would generate anything of substance. How did you view it?
So I actually viewed it as actually something extremely positive and hopeful. Hmm. I think that, you know, we are witnessing a time in history that, you know, just like Rabbi Settle was saying, that is just like, you know, I'd always remember hearing stories from my parents and from my grandmother about the 60s and the Freedom Riders and, you know, what that was like on the ground. And it's like, you know, I think that, you know, people in high places are now starting to see that, you know, these movements are not going away and that they're actually galvanizing and inspiring people in high place to actually do something about these problems. So I think that these organizations, Black Lives Matter and, you know, other organizations around the country are starting to push and push hard, and they're starting to see there's actually movement because the people are engaged. And when the people are engaged, then these people in government in high places start to listen.
Ida Perez, how do you feel about, you know, the kind of work that you think is maybe within reach and the kind of work that you think that your work on the Police Accountability Board ought to be focused on next?
Well, definitely the relation part of it. I think in my case, you know, because of where I live, I live right in the smack in the middle of North Clinton Avenue, where there's a lot of stuff going on. And as a active member there, you know, I've seen both sides. I've seen, you know, the side where police officers have had to come in and kind of, for lack of a better word, you know, hammer down on folks that live there. But then I've also seen the part where they've worked hand by hand with community organizers like myself, you know, to help bring change, positive change into our community. So, you know, I'm optimistic that a lot can be done in a positive way. You know, it's just a matter, again, of a change of mindset from all parts, whether it's officers and how they view the community and then community and how they view the officers. So I'm hoping that the work that we do will bring some transparency to which is what people want, right? They want to know what happened to that officer that maybe made that minor offense, because those minor offenses, you know, with if not dealt with quickly, can lead into bigger offenses, and that's how we end up with situations like we've had with Floyd. But, you know, again, that transparency that the community wants and needs, and then the willingness of the police department to be able to offer those transparency, I think when we get to that point, we'll be in a good place.
Some questions from the audience. Ida, I'll start with you on this. Christy has two very different points. Christy says, how about actively recruiting more women officers, as women are less violent than men, as research has shown? And then she says, also, I think all officers should be trained in the martial arts. It should be part of police training that officers must be at least brown belts. Two very different points from Christy. Ida, what do you think?
Well, I don't know what I would do if I was trained with a brown belt. But I think part of that is the problem, right? The training that they receive. I think oftentimes officers, and I've heard officers say this. In fact, I heard one say this yesterday, where they're told to do a job, but they're not necessarily told how to do that job. And so I think sometimes officers come into the community, you know, they see certain issues, and of course they're going to, you know, go and aggressively address those issues without knowing how to do that in a different way. So I think that, part of that is the training that they receive, because I don't feel that they receive the right type of training of how to actually go into communities, and into communities of color in particular, you know, to know the culture, to know how that is. Because when you come into our community, we're loving, caring, hugging, kissing. Well, not so much now, but, you know, that's the type of community that we are. But officers are not going to know that if they don't know the community. So I think more than martial arts and things of that nature is really knowing culture and knowing diversity and being trained in those areas.
All right, Rabbi, our listener Christy says more women on the force and more martial arts training.
So definitely more women, but I want to mention one, you know, out of a police force of 739, there are only 99 women at the moment, so that's very problematic. But that issue of culture applies to women as much to men. You know, I wish I could say that women handle power better than men do, but I sadly don't see evidence of that. So I think that women can be part of a culture, a dysfunctional culture, as much as men can be, and that part of bringing women in is also part of addressing that culture, also for the sake of the women. I know that there's a lot of misogyny and a lot of harassment that has happened to women in police departments, and so again, this is part of the systematic change. My understanding is that police officers do incorporate martial arts tactics into their training. Whether there's a specific discipline or not, I don't think is usual, but certainly they are given that. And I think that that's more a question too about de-escalation and how we move away from armed force in police-civilian encounters. And I think obviously that's a very significant conversation to have, and there's no single answer to it.
Dr. McIntosh, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I believe that diversity and inclusion does matter, but it shouldn't just stop at more women on the force. I mean, we need more people of color, we need more Asians, we need more Puerto Ricans or Latina descent. We need a diversity, period, and especially in these communities. In addition to that, not necessarily the martial arts, but I agree with more de-escalation training, more bias training, and definitely more trauma-informed training, because, and even mental health providers, mental health training for the officers, or just some resources for them as well. But definitely trauma-informed training.
Shawnee Wilson, you want to weigh in on that too?
So I agree with everyone with what they've said so far. Only thing that I'll get back to is the system changes. You know, honestly, folks, like I wouldn't want to put someone in a situation where, you know, just like Rabbi Settle was saying, you know, that women, you know, there's only 99 women on the police force right now locally. And, you know, you are coming into a culture that we know of that is misogynistic. And, you know, unless these systems address these problems of misogyny, address the problems that, you know, women are routinely not heard, and not saying that this happens, you know, here, because I don't have direct evidence of that, but, you know, where we know that in a lot of these systems that they're not heard or not seen, or just that they have to acclimate into that misogyny, that I would much rather work on system changes, like, you know, bias training, just like mental health training, making sure that they know how to deal with, you know, different parts of the public, and actually see that there's a consistent commitment to do those things before you start, you know, pumping more people into a system that already needs to be fixed. That's what I'd like to see happen.
Okay. A couple more listener questions. Someone else want to weigh in? I heard someone there. Go ahead.
So it's Dr. McIntosh. And I just wanted to say it's very important for this to be top down. It can't just be the officers everyone in the system needs to definitely get the training and be on the same accord.
So Todd, a listener named Todd on Twitter is asking, and I think, Shawnee Wilson, this referred to a comment you made about 900 incidents, 16 claims upheld, something like that. Was that the stat that you gave earlier this
week? That was Dr. McIntosh who made that statement.
Oh, Dr. McIntosh. Yeah. So Todd is wondering, is the guest who brought those numbers up implying that there's something wrong with only 16 out of 900 claims being upheld?
Well, what I would say is that those claims are what was the impetus behind the PAB being formed. So I that's what I would say.
Okay.
I guess to answer plainly, the community, that's not enough for the community.
Okay.
The community did not feel like that was accountable, that was not representative of, or they didn't feel like, you know, out of all those cases, only 16 of them, you know, were, and then basically none of them ended up in firing. It was just six of them were suspensions. So the community feels like that's not enough. And that's not right. Out of 900 complaints of excessive force, that wasn't a good enough number.
All right. Let me get Ted on the line in Rochester. Go ahead, Ted.
Hey, everybody. First of all, thank you, board members, for your service. You are in uncharted waters, and you're doing a great job, and I uphold you all. Secondly, around the state, we're seeing municipalities attempt to pass PABs. There's work being done in Geneva right now. I know Buffalo wants to expand their power, so does Syracuse. Kingston, New York wants to maybe get on board with this action. I'm wondering if you have any advice to other groups of civilian citizens, municipal governments, and other cities about this process and about what you would change or things you thought went really well.
Okay. Thank you, Ted. Shawnee Wilson?
So I would say that I really loved the one of the things that I thought worked really well is, you know, I applaud the Police Accountability Board Alliance being able to work with City Council on getting this passed. I know that it was, you know, quite a process. There were 54 different agencies within the alliance, and so to try to herd everybody together and then get them to work with City Council and then saw that this thing passed with 75% of the voters voting for it is just amazing and astounding. So I liked the ability to work together within those agencies. I think I would just tell them, I mean, my advice to people that are doing that is that, you know, this is a very long process to make sure that you, you know, are in it for the long haul and that you have a thorough, knowledge and understanding as to, you know, what's going on within your cities, what you want to change, and then how to actually engage those processes within your government. So, like, you know, advocating, you know, protesting, talking to people, making sure that they understand exactly what you want. And then one thing I would change is I would definitely change, you know, I believe that, you know, that the voting for members of the PAB, you know, should, you know, my wish would be that, you know, it would begin and end with the people. And, you know, I know that, you know, and I, you know, humbly thank all that the City Council has done, but I, you know, going forward, I would have said to others that, you know, I really would like for, you know, the city to have the final say on who's approved for each position. Like, that would be my personal wish, even outside just my own statement, apart from just the PAB.
All right. Dr. McIntosh.
I guess what I would say would be network, definitely network with other groups that have done this before or in the process. I'm sure that our group may also be willing to network and, you know, offer any advice that we can give. But I would definitely say collaboration is the way to go.
Ida Perez.
I would say the same. I think it's important for to have some, I think we could have had more diversity in regards to the population that we serve. And perhaps there might be some groups that we're missing around the table that have, you know, direct experiences and not good experiences with the police that could be represented through our table. We're hoping that, right, we'll continue to keep those people in mind and voice for them. But I also agree that I think the community should have had more say on who was on the board.
All right. And Rabbi Settle.
I think they covered it. I really don't have anything to add for that.
Well, then, in 20 seconds, Shawnee Wilson, what do you want to leave with the public as we try to understand the PAB? The last 30 seconds or so is yours.
Hi, Rochester. The Police Accountability Board is still working on your behalf. We are working diligently, and we are trying to fulfill your wishes and having an independent oversight into Rochester policing. And we ask for your support. We ask for you to come alongside us in this effort. And we thank you for your belief in us. We thank you for standing next to us.
Shawnee Wilson is the chair of the Police Accountability Board and a physician assistant who specializes in internal medicine. Thank you for helping put this conversation together. And I know there's certain things PAB can and can't do or can and can't say, but I appreciate all the perspective on the work you're doing. Thanks for being here, Shawnee.
Thank you.
Dr. Celia McIntosh, the vice chair of the PAB, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Ida Perez, who is a member of the board and director of Ibero Early Childhood Services, thank you, Ida.
Thank you.
And Rabbi Dror Settle, also a member of the board. Thank you, Rabbi Settle.
You're very welcome.
Short break. More Connections coming up next.